Accession number 28921, Reel 2.
Like to ask you, Kitty, I obviously know your story from the Holocaust exhibition, and in fact it's the second time that I've seen this film. I find myself wondering at the end what it was like for you in the immediate post-war years, living with your mother and having gone through that experience. Did you look back on it? Did you talk about it a great deal? Or did you really bury it so that really you're...
No, we constantly discussed it between us in the house freely. And that was an enormous help to my children, I think, because it was never sort of swept under the carpet. It came up in everyday life, at every meal. There was food on the table, and my mother would take little bits of food and put them in the fridge, and the children would say, ah, here she goes again. She's got to save a little bit, because in Auschwitz there wasn't any food, and you couldn't waste it. And, you know, little things like this. And so it came up in everyday life. Never the real horror, but sort of every day-to-day survival came up every day in our daily life. And I think, in a way, it helped both my mother and myself to come to terms with what had happened.
So that she was a help to you after that experience as well? It was an ongoing sort of...
Yes, because there were many things that I had forgotten that she'd remembered. And, you know, it was like a two-way remembrance. And, of course, she had slightly different experiences because we were parted for 8 months, so we could exchange what really happened to her. And she didn't know what happened to me while I was in Canada. She knew nothing about this because although people in the camp knew what was going on there, they'd never actually witnessed the things that the people in Canada had witnessed. So there was like a two-way dialogue throughout the years.
Mm.
Although we've had an extremely difficult time in Birmingham the first few years, as you probably know, nonetheless, we decided one has to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
And not only I have to talk about it to my sons, but I made a conscious effort. I knew that as a survivor, I had a duty to tell everybody else what had happened. And, of course, that was very difficult after the war because not people didn't particularly want to hear what we had to say.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that and about the writing of your book? What took you to do that at such a relatively early time?
My first manuscript goes back to 1946, where I realized that so many things had happened. Somehow or other, I had to document it, and if I didn't do it immediately, I shall not remember the detail. So I started writing 1946 and progressed until 1961, when my first book came out. And, of course, after we did Return to Auschwitz, I did it again because there were so many more things that came to life that I'd forgotten, and a lot of research had been done. It was necessary to actually do it all over again. But what I would like to try and say, just as something that Peter said in his introduction about the Women of Courage, they were doing this series, Women at War, Women of Courage, and I realized I didn't fit into this for very good reason. Nothing to do with my maturity or immaturity, as you said, but I hadn't done anything spectacular. These women had all done some incredible deeds, saved people. Well, it's just amazing what they've done, whereas I was just a survivor. I hadn't done anything, and I felt it just wasn't fair for me to be, you know, put into the situation with these marvelous women. That was one of the reasons. The other reason was that I couldn't see how you could fit in 7 years of my experiences into a 30-minute episode. And Auschwitz itself, it's such a huge, huge subject. You just couldn't do it in 30 minutes. Now, and the other reason I wanted to go back so badly was that for years I tried desperately to explain Auschwitz. I'd written, and of course you can't explain it. You can read as much as you like, but you can never really recapture the atmosphere of Auschwitz, if that's what you call it. And I realized to go back would enable the viewers to come physically into the camp and maybe understand something because that's what you had to do to understand Auschwitz. You really have to physically go there. And of course it wasn't possible in the 70s and the 80s. We went in 1978, it's 25 years ago. Poland was under communism, he couldn't travel to Poland. Well, you could, but it was difficult. But today, of course, it's a different world. Survivors have been back and they've got thousands and thousands of visitors. And so it is a different world. But in those days, and the impact, I think, was because it was for the very first time people realized what Auschwitz was all about. It had never been done before. And thank you, Peter, for doing it, because it actually never been done until we'd actually gone and seen it for ourselves. Mm. That was amazing. And today, may I just say, today, we at the Holocaust Educational Trust sent plane loads of students and teachers twice a year to Auschwitz for the day, on day trips. Now, you might think it's a ridiculous thing to do, but in fact, it's known as Lessons from Auschwitz, and it's a most successful project, and the students come back and they have a tremendous experience, which they would never have had before. And the teachers, it enables them to help them to teach. And when these students come back, they go into their respective schools and do a presentation of what they've seen and talk about Auschwitz. So it's a wonderful project, actually. And then they come back here after the visit to you, and they do a post-Auschwitz seminar, and I usually do the pre-Auschwitz seminar. So
that's it. Thank you. Could I turn now to you, Peter, and ask you to just tell us a little bit about the impact that the film made when it was first broadcast, please?
Well, the impact on me, of course, was absolutely tremendous. You know, I didn't think I could put my head on a pillow at night time for about 2 years without thinking about that experience of taking Kitty back there. And I'd like to think that the way that we shot it and really gave Kitty the total freedom to never stop talking and always remembering things, I think that was a way of portraying what it was like. There have been many films about Auschwitz, but I think this really got very close to the bone of it. And I was rather hoping that people got that from that film.
Yes,
this way.
I'm sure they did. And what about the public's response and the press response?
That was incredible.
That was tremendous.
It was tremendous.
Yes, it got huge ratings. It got a really interesting press response. And it was shown all over the world. I think it's been shown in every country. In America,
five times, I think.
Yeah, but PBS twice, and then ABC picked it up, and they did a very sort of un-American thing. They actually showed a British documentary in peak time, coast to coast, on a major network.
Yes.
And what's more, they flew us over in Concorde to be there. You know what you say? Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Could I make a point about? I think. It's maybe easy when you see this film to sort of take this approach for granted, because there have been other films since that have taken maybe a similar approach to the approach that Peter's made. But actually, it reminded me, again watching, and I've watched it actually quite a few times now, and like all really good pieces of work, you always find new things in it. And I saw it, there was a film that Steven Spielberg was involved in making recently, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is called The Last Train or the Final Train or something, which is about the Hungarian, the Holocaust that was experienced by the people of Hungary, which is a very good documentary in many ways. But one of the weaknesses of that film when I watched it was that it tries to get one story out of many, many stories of about five or six Hungarian survivors. And it struck me at the time that it didn't work for that reason, that in a way trying to aggregate a story of the Holocaust through many stories is really impossible,
no,
because everyone has got a...
It's different.
Exactly. Mm. And I think what's really striking about Peter's film and the film he made with Kitty, because it's both their films really, is that he didn't do that. He actually did something much more difficult, which was he took the risk of just taking one person. Now, when we see Kitty's film, it's obvious that you don't need to have anyone else in it. But that was actually a very brave step to take, and it was important not to do that, to focus on one person, not to aggregate the story, which is always the temptation with a subject quite as enormous as that. Oh, there's so many things, we must draw all of them in. And actually, it's much more profound just to look at one story.
Yeah.
And I think the great advantage was in the way, and this will interest you as an archivist, that the word pictures that Kitty paints were so strong that I had about three calls after transmission of people asking, where did we get that amazing black and white archive footage from? Because, you know, they've seen films about Holocaust, etc., about Belsen largely, which aren't people's. Now, there's not really much footage, in fact, hardly any at all about Auschwitz. But somehow they saw it as she was speaking.
And that really?
Absolutely.
Oh, wow. So the pictures have been built up in their minds.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can I make just one other little comment? The other thing I thought was that the editing is absolutely fantastic. And one of the things that you do, and I'd like to ask you about that, Peter, is that you use the landscape shots without Kitty in immediately there very cleverly. It's almost like a break. It's like several natural pauses that you put in to the film. And they're very good because, first of all, they give the audience time to breathe, because you need to breathe, because this is a very harrowing story. It comes at quite a pace, and you need time to collect your thoughts. And also, they let that landscape speak for itself. And I thought that structure was very, very clever. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yes, well, I was determined to do that because I'd imported from Warsaw, you know, a dolly and tracks we could lay, and all those shots were done after Kitty had gone back to England. And I felt not only did one need some respite from this marvellous lady, you know, one really needed to have a break, but there were sort of these exactly the shots. For instance, the latrine block. I think there are 82 holes. I think in that. I think it was. You know,
and that you know,
and that had to be lit. And we had a few lights with us. And the good people at Auschwitz actually told me that the outside perimeter lights were still working. And we ran a cable, and they twisted them up, and we got a few lights into this place to film that shot. And so I think these shots really were a breather and also to make a comment. You know, the one that always, for me, works very well is just tracking along the side of one of the huts, and then you go around the corner, then you see a whole row of them develop. Just to give this is really what I meant by trying to get across, and I don't know how successful this has been, bloody size of the place, which was so appalling, you know, to try and see. Quite often when they were walking round the hospital blocks, you know, where just the chimneys were standing, we stood away about 100 yards and just used the sound, which we could record, but just to give the, you know, to give it scale, really.
Maybe we should see if there are any questions.
Fine, yes. Now, questions from the audience. Yes, the lady in the black and white jacket, and there's a roving microphone. So if you'd like to use that.
Come here, Hector. I greatly admired your film, which I've seen for the second time, but I felt that a salient point had been omitted, and that is the film failed to say that all this happened to Jews.
Oh, no.
And it happened to Jews because they were Jews. I wonder if you'd care to comment on that.
You answer that. You know that.
Well, it's...
It does say, actually.
First of all, it's a film about Auschwitz. It's seeing what happened in Auschwitz through the eyes of one survivor. So it's not a story about the extermination of Jews. It isn't a story about that, although that is totally implicit. But it is stated very clearly that Kitty was Jewish. Yes, it is, on two occasions. Is there anybody here who's got any doubts whether Kitty is Jewish or not? Well, there's your answer. You know, you just might, forgive me, but you must have missed that point. Yes, you certainly have. I mean, can you think of it that Kitty's father actually had to come to an arrangement with a Catholic priest in order to give Aryan papers to his wife and his daughter and to send them into Germany. Can you imagine somebody having the courage to do that? Oh, yes, it was.
At the beginning, a Jewish family.
Yeah. Oh, dear. I think we ought to change the subject.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to the next question? The gentleman in beige, yes. Please, there's a microphone on its way.
In a way, it's to follow that up, but in a slightly different way. If it's not too impertinent, because you've given so much of yourself, Kitty, are you actually personally a person of any religious convictions? And if so, what effect did being in Auschwitz and thinking about it afterwards have on that?
Well, I must say that this question comes up every time I speak. It doesn't matter where I speak, if it's a college, if it just doesn't matter where. Religion always comes up. And I can only say the same thing over and over again. Auschwitz had a different effect on different people. Some people became very religious because they said, oh, there's a God and I survived because God helped me to survive. So you have these type of people. You have other people who completely lost their faith for the simple reason they'll turn around and say, where was God? Where was God? These were innocent people. There was a program on Radio 2, I hope you listened to it, with Jeremy Wine, where they were talking about the God. I really wanted to phone in, but I thought, well, I better stay out. But there was this question about God. And if people had been in Auschwitz and seen what I had seen, they would have questioned it. Is there a God? There were these innocent children being burnt alive, which I've seen. Where was God? To punish people? This is what was said on Radio 2. God has to punish people to make them better. Well, there are a lot of people who have lost their faith, and I've lost my faith in God in Auschwitz, because there wasn't a God in Auschwitz.
Fine. Any further questions? Yes, the lady in the turquoise, in the blue T-shirt.
Wanted to ask more about your experience. When you were in there, what kind of information did you have of what was going on with the war? What did you imagine? You must have speculated amongst yourselves.
There were rumours, but there was no information. Any information you had from newcomers, and they didn't have any particular information. So it's mostly misinformation. Of course, we did realise in 1944 that things were going badly for the Germans when they began to evacuate Auschwitz. We realized people were being brought in from Majdanek, which was outside Lublin. They were being brought in because there was a Russian advance. So we knew the front was somewhere around there and they were fighting there, but we had no idea of the state of the war. We didn't know that the Germans were fighting in Italy and in Africa, anything like this. We had no idea.
Someone back at the back as well, isn't it? This chap's been waiting.
Yes,
for a
gentleman in the navy.
Well, if you can just wait for the mic, please, and then we can make sure we get it recorded.
You'll answer the mic.
Sorry.
Yeah, you never know whether this is loud enough, actually.
Is this all right? Yeah.
Yes. To follow on from that,
if
in
you
the
can
film,
use your mic so we can hear.
Yes.
That'd be great. Thank you.
To follow on from that, in the film, it was implicit that you knew at one point that you were going to win.
I was going to
win. There was going to be revenge, and that you were going to win. Can you tell us if the Germans knew that they were going to lose?
Well, of course, I will tell you that we had no direct contact with the Germans because you couldn't speak to any of the SS personnel to have a conversation with them. I mean, they didn't introduce themselves to you and say, "I'm SS so and so." A Kramer or whatever. So you had absolutely no contact with the actual SS. They were always distant from the ordinary prisoners. They would only associate, if you call this, with the ruling prisoners. So we don't know what was in their minds, or even if they did know, they wouldn't have let on. There was no contact.
Fine, thank you. The lady in cream here. Thanks, Kath.
Thank you. Kitty, the question that I was going to ask was asked straight away by the lady. If you spoke after the war about your experiences with people, which you answered, I'd like to just make one comment. I watched this documentary in 1979. I was 20 years old.
Oh, right.
And I never, ever forgot you. I've told all my nephews, my sister's children, all about you, especially the part when you said you wanted revenge and how, in the end, your humanity took over. You will never be forgotten. and the work that you do now will always be passed on, and we'll never forget what you went through.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to hear that. Yeah. Thank you.
And if so, could you give us your views on it? How well do you think it works? Is it an appropriate thing? And do you feel that it's in the right setting and the right way to do it?
Well, I came here many, many years ago looking for a Holocaust exhibition. I don't know what year it was. It might have been in the 70s. It was before we did Return to Auschwitz, I think. And I was looking for somewhere to see something about the Holocaust. And what I saw, it just shook me, I must say. It was just one corner somewhere, wasn't it? With a few posters or something. And I thought, my God, is that the best that can be done in this country? I was absolutely horrified. And, of course, after having been to the States with the film, and I've been subsequently to the States lecturing, having seen many Holocaust exhibitions in very tiny places, I just was beside myself. And to see this exhibition here today, well, it's just a revelation. So it's wonderful. I think it's, and of course it proved to be so, hasn't it? I mean, educationally, there's tremendous interest. Of course, the subject is now in schools, and schools have to take it up. And that's the Holocaust Trust that managed to get the subject into the schools, the trust that I work with. It's been very successful from your point of view, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's had, as I mentioned earlier this evening, it's had very nearly a million visitors now. But I think more importantly than sheer numbers has been the qualitative response of visitors. Right. And they clearly just gain an enormous amount from that. We know that from the little white cards that visitors write on at the end of their visits, and they talk about the... the lessons it has for getting on with your neighbours, and for the how much it teaches about the importance of preserving our democratic institutions and not letting tyrants like Hitler come to power. And as Rabbi Gwynne says at the end of the exhibition, of knowing your neighbours and ultimately. Making a plea for greater racial integration and a more tolerant world. And I think it's very rewarding for all of us who worked on the exhibition. And, of course, Kitty Hart's testimony can be seen on the screen in the exhibition. And so she's one of 16 survivors whose memories are sort of stored up there and running continuously, and for all of them and for us, it's been tremendously rewarding that it has had such a strong impact. Thank you. Yes, the gentleman in the brown jacket. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm following on one of the points made a little bit earlier. Was there any sign of information coming in from the Polish underground into the camp?
Well, there was a very, very powerful Polish underground. We know that. They even parachuted them in and of course, took them out again. But mostly in the men's camp, and, of course, there was no contact between the women's camp and the men's, no official contact between the men's camp and the women's camp. There was also a resistance movement in the women's camp. But because there were so many informers, no one really knew who these people were. It was very dangerous for anyone to know, because the SS planted all these informers, because there were a lot of German prisoners there, and they were actually informing. They were listening out who were in the underground. And, of course, it is very well known that when we did have this uprising in October 1944, it was premature. But because there were so many informers, they had already had an inkling that there was going to be an uprising. So the Sonderkommando had no option but to just blow up this one crematorium. And it was all premature, and, of course, they all got killed. So we didn't know there was an underground. We didn't know there was resistance, or we didn't know who they were. No. Anonymous.
The gentleman in the pink shirt. Yes, do you... Thanks, Hasina.
Kitty, I'd like to ask you, when the crematorium was blown up, you said that you obtained munitions Who did you obtain the munitions from?
Well, we in the Canada did not obtain the ammunition. The men in the Sonderkommando who were separate, they had ammunition. What happened was all the jewellery and gold that was found had to be handed in. Well, some of it, of course, as you've seen, we buried. And when there was an opportunity, we managed to get it to the men. And the men managed to get some of this jewellery to some of the women who were working in a munition factory called the Unionwerke, that's it, where they were actually making explosives. And the girls working there bribed some of the workers with this jewellery. That was like a chain reaction. And there were four girls that smuggled these explosives into the men. How they did it, I don't know. But, of course, after the inquiry, they were found out, and all four girls were hung. They found them, all of them. We were all implicated, but they couldn't prove it. A lot of the Sonderkommando men were killed because, of course, they actually had the ammunition. But in Canada, we didn't have any ammunition, and they couldn't prove we had any gold or anything, but we didn't hold it. You couldn't have anything on you because you were searched. So if you did find something and you couldn't bury it, you had to get rid of it very quickly. You either had to hand it in or you had to have some means of getting it to the men. And once there was a group of men came in to do some repair work, and they had some buckets, and I think they had some soup in these buckets. And I managed to pass this group of men and drop a load of jewellery into this bucket of soup or something. And I was very nearly caught then, yeah, because they were supervised. So this was how it found itself there. Mm-hmm. Very complicated. It was a chain reaction.
Good. I think just one more question. Gentleman in brown. And then I think we must finish.
Kitty, thank you for your time tonight. The question I have is, after liberation, you were in a displacement camp with your mother and presumably had very little in terms of possessions or wealth and so on. How did you then get over to Birmingham? Was there an organisation that helped? And why Birmingham? Were there any family roots or...?
Well, my personal story follows that I worked in the DP camp for the Quaker relief team. And there was an organization, like a American joint organization, there was UNRWA, wasn't it, the United Nations Relief Organization. They were resettling people later on, not quite early on, but we worked for the British military government, my mother and I as interpreters, and for the Quaker relief team. And there were some people in the Quaker relief team whose daughter, there's a lady who was one of the Quakers, whose daughter is there, Daphne. Stand up, Daphne. That's it. It's her mother, actually, that got the permit for my mother and me to come to England. She was responsible, actually, for that, her mother, Jane. And the reason we came to Birmingham is because I had some relatives in Birmingham.
Fine. I think there was just one last question. Yes, the gentleman in the navy jacket at the back there, please.
That's right.
Can I just return to the making of the film briefly, please? I was very surprised during your introduction, Peter, when you said that the night before the day spent in Auschwitz, you briefed Kitty that you were going to say nothing to her throughout the day. Can I ask you, did you break that and say anything at all? And can I ask Kitty, what was your reaction when Peter told you that in the evening?
Well, I certainly did not speak to her. You know, it was it was touch and go, but I did not speak.
In fact, yeah. when we got to Krakow, I thought I had done something terribly wrong because they wouldn't speak to me. I said to David, I don't know what's the matter with these people or what I've done because they won't speak to me. And he says, I don't know, I can't understand why they don't speak to me. But then I realised he didn't really want me to.
But I've got a footnote to speaking. Because when we'd finished and Kitty was on the way back. We stayed on, as I say, for another couple of days to do these pickup shots. And then I stayed on in Warsaw for a week to do one of the Women of Courage films, shooting it with the same Yorkshire Television crew. Came back to England, rang up Kitty. I was desperate to find out how she felt now that she's been.